Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This fusion between what political party says, what the media says, and what the Supreme Court judgment says, this is almost identical. There was a circulation of a video showing two Christian women in Manipur. They speak one language, right, and that language is of an ethnic Hindu nationalism.
Just lay out why the Mughal Empire is so problematic to these Hindutva people.
Elements of Gandhi's thought is so violent, especially when it comes to Muslim issues.
India's 200 million Muslims are at the mercy of an ultra-nationalist government that looks to create an exclusively Hindu Bharat, or homeland. Since the rise of the BJP government, led by Narendra Modi, Muslims have been subject to discrimination, alienation, daily religious abuse, economic marginalization, state-sanctioned mob violence, and pogroms like that in Gujarat in 2002. The Hindu nationalism is underpinned by a pernicious cultural and political ideology, Hindutva, framed by an antagonism towards Islam and a rewriting of Indian history. My guest today, Professor Irfan Ahmed, will help us understand the precarious state of India's Muslims and the Hindutva ideology. Born in India, he now lives in Istanbul, where he is a professor of sociology and anthropology at Ibn Khaldun University. Prior to Istanbul, he was a research professor in Germany at the Max Planck Institute, and he has taught anthropology and politics in Netherlands and Australia. He has written numerous books and articles on India and Islam, and recently published a provocative piece on Hindu Orientalism, which I'm sure we're going to explore today. Professor Irfan Ahmed, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, and it's a pleasure to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me. I'm also very happy to be here, and I have watched some of your programs, and I think intervention like yours is very important for our time.
Well, it's really a pleasure to have you with us, and actually, we're speaking in a week which has been marked by some very disturbing scenes in India, and I'm sure we're going to pick up on that as we go along today. So let's begin with the reality on the ground. Can you please paint a picture of the life of ordinary Muslims in India today?
In one sentence, I think Muslims, and it is not just ordinary Muslims, both ordinary and non-ordinary, their condition today in India is marked by a state of complete terror. You mentioned this situation in last week. Muslims have been killed in the train, and the guy, the police officer who killed. So, of course, now he is being depicted in the media as somebody who is mentally stable, unstable.
Yes.
But, of course, there was a method in the way he killed these Muslims, because it was not like a random shooting.
Yeah.
He was moving from one coast to another and identifying Muslim with the visible marker like beard. Okay? So these three Muslims have been killed in two separate coaches.
Really?
Yes. So the point is, so this is one incident. Another incident which has happened in Gurgaon, which, by the way, is very close to the capital.
Right. So if we were to look at this map here that you've asked me to put up, Gurgaon, it would be where?
So you see, it is on the top in north.
Right, here.
So it is Delhi.
Yeah.
Technically, Gurgaon is part of Haryana.
Right.
But it is very close to Delhi. So if you were to drive by car, it will be like 20, 25 minutes.
Yeah. And why is that so significant? Why is being close to Delhi very significant?
Because, of course, it is the capital of India.
Yes.
Where you have parliament, you have a prime minister who lives there.
Right.
So this is happening right under the nose of people who rule India.
Yes.
Now, in Gurgaon, there was a masjid, and it is not a full-fledged masjid. It was a makeshift masjid.
Yes.
And a very young imam, his name is Hafiz Saad. So the mob went, first attacked the masjid, and there, I think there were four or five people who were attacked. This young imam, he was killed. He died in the hospital. This young imam is from the same estate where I come from.
Really?
In fact, from the same district as well, Sitamarhi. So you see this, and in Gurgaon in the past, there has been, so this is not the first attack on masjid, for example. Mm. It has happened before because, you know, this is also... Gurgaon is important as part of this new India, like new offices,
right.
Towers, IT offices, and so on. Mm. So you have Muslims who work there, but their number is very low.
Yes.
So they come for Friday prayer.
Mm.
Okay. So in some cases, they have been doing it in the open. In that kind of prayer also, they have been attacked.
Really?
There have been several reports. So this has happened not one time, but many times. Yeah. So the point here is that this state of terror, which Muslims have been subjected to, and especially it has increased since 2014.
Yes.
When Modi came to power.
Yeah.
So what I want to say that this state of terror is as a state in the sense of condition.
Right.
So the condition of Muslims, it is marked by like social disposition.
Right.
It is marked by discrimination. It is marked by their worsening economic status.
Yeah.
Their low representation in government jobs. There are very few Muslims who find a way to go to the university, to the higher education.
Right.
So this is what I mean, a state as a condition. But then this condition of Muslims is definitely connected to the state as regime of power.
Yeah.
Now, let me illustrate this, what I mean by this. So these kind of attacks, which I described here, when it happens, either the state is silent, and sometimes it also indirectly encourages.
Right.
Encourages not by acting against the criminals.
Yes.
Okay? So in the case of lynching, not only that the government doesn't take action, you have a case from Jharkhand, which is in the north.
Right.
Close to Bihar.
Right.
Earlier it was part of Bihar.
Just over here, yes.
Yeah. Now... 20 years ago, it was created as a separate state.
Yes.
So there, Muslims were lynched, and those who lynched Muslims, you have a politician who not only spoke in favor of these Hindu lynchers, if that is a word, like lyncher, but when he went and actually gave bouquet to those who had lynched Muslims.
So flowers to those who lynched the Muslims.
Yes.
Wow.
And
this was a politician, the local politician in the area?
Yes.
Oh.
And that politician is not an insignificant one.
Yeah.
He's quite a significant politician who has fought national elections.
Really?
You know?
Yeah.
So in that sense, you see the state of terror that I'm speaking about, a state as a general condition and also a state in terms of the political regime or the power, they are connected. Now, this raises an important question that can we talk about democracy and terror? Because clearly, India projects itself. And in a way, it is, because every 5 years, there is an election.
Mm.
So this raises the question that, is there a connection between democracy and terror?
Yeah.
Now, of course, most theorists would say that actually terror is opposite of democracy.
Yeah.
But I think historically, terror and democracy have coexisted.
Right.
Now, you remember the famous or the infamous statement that Roosevelt made. And it is something like this, that the extermination of Indians was ultimately beneficial as it was inevitable. If you look at the history of democracy in Australia, the extermination of Aboriginal population, it is bound up with democracy.
Right.
It is bound up with nationalism.
Mm. Can I ask you about, we hear a lot on social media, we hear about cow vigilantes. Who are these cow vigilantes? Can you just explain, because it sounds like a very strange idea. Just explain what's going on there.
I've written about this term cow vigilante or cow vigilantism elsewhere. I think the term itself is problematic.
Right.
Now, why? Because the idea of cow vigilante is, I mean, the word vigilance is a positive term, that we have to keep a vigil on something, right? So the idea here is that these are people who are engaged in a good cause, namely that they are maintaining a vigil against those who are either, the term which is used in the Indian media, those who are smuggling cows.
Mm.
So it is not about every animal.
Yes.
Particularly cow.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
I think for me, the term cow vigilante is problematic because what you have here, these are criminals.
Right.
Because once you take law into your own hand, and if a poor Muslim is exporting animals, including cow, and you surround him, you start beating him, and in many cases, they have been killed. So the word cow vigilante here is not appropriate. It is, from a legal perspective, they should be described as criminals, at least.
Yeah.
There are some people, and I have also used this term, that can we also talk about cow terrorist? Because by killing these Muslims in the name of cow vigilantism, what is the purpose? The purpose is to strike a terror in the hearts and minds of Muslims.
Yes.
So cow vigilante is, of course, and this will take us to a little bit of history. Now, the Indian Constitution is understood in the West as secular. But here we must make a distinction that the word secular was inserted in the Constitution only in mid-70s.
Right.
So from 47, when India got independence, until 76 or 77, you don't have the word secular. It was inserted. But if you take the idea of India as a secular state.
Yes.
So constitution has different parts. In the part which is called directive principles of the state policy, that constitution, in that part, it says that the state will try to ban beef. Okay? So it has not been implemented.
Yes.
At a federal level.
Yes.
But different states have implemented it.
Really?
Now, after the rise of Modi,
yes,
this has become a hot issue. And it is not simply enforced by the law enforcing agencies, but also these cow vigilantes,
right,
okay, who are civil society, technically speaking.
Yes.
So these are young people who are affiliated to either directly or indirectly,
yeah,
to the Hindutva organizations.
Yes.
And indirectly, they also have protection from the police and from the civil administration.
So can I ask about this? What is the relationship between the state, the government, these civil society actors like the RSS, the police and the perpetrators, the mobs who conduct these public lynchings?
This is really a great question, because we cannot understand the health of a democracy which really believes in justice without this question about the interrelationship between state and society, and also between the different organs of the state. Now, as we know, liberal democracy is based on the idea of differentiation of different realms, okay, judiciary, executive, and legislative. Now, people who have written about fascism, there are many explanations of fascism, but one key explanation of fascism which bears on our discussion is that what happens under a fascist order,
yes,
is that different aspects of the society and different institutions of the state, they fuse. There is a almost complete identification, and the space between the state and society and different institutions of the civil society, that completely disappears.
So it fuses together.
Yeah. So what the politician says and what the civil society says, what the media says, they become almost one identity, one unified voice.
Right.
And that is dangerous because the defenses, the dissenting voices, they are simply eliminated. And in the case of India, you see this, if you want to use this word called fusion of different organs of the state as well as the society. Now, the first example of this fusion, and let's keep this idea of how fascism works in practice. It fuses,
yes,
these separate realms into one.
Yeah.
So you see, the RSS and BJP, they have been working hard to demolish the Babri Masjid, which was eventually demolished in 1992. Now, if you take RSS and BJP as political parties.
RSS being, by the way, just a quick explanation.
So RSS is an organization which the full name is Rashtriya Swayam Sevak Sangh. In English, if you translate it, it would be National Volunteer Association.
Right.
So the name itself is quite innocent.
Yes.
But as we'll explain it later,
please. Yeah.
It has got a quite violent ideology as well as practice.
And the BJP is the government in power, the political party of the ruling party.
That is correct.
Yes.
So they have been campaigning for building of the Ram Temple, which also means demolishing the Babri Masjid.
Yes.
So if you take BJP and RSS as actor in civil society, because this is how political parties are, right? Taken as civil society actors.
Yes.
Now, what they have been saying for decades, the Supreme Court, in its judgment, it said the same thing. And then media says the same thing. So this fusion between what political party says, what the media says, and what the Supreme Court judgment says, this is almost identical.
Right.
And that is where you see this fusion between the state and the society.
Really.
And that is one way to understand fascism. Likewise, in our contemporary world, media is very important in order to shape our public opinion and so on.
Mm.
Now, there are many people who say that, well, India is a vibrant democracy. We have so many media houses. We have media pluralism and so on.
Mm.
So on the face of it, it looks very attractive.
Mm.
But I'm not interested so much as a political anthropologist or a social philosopher in the diversity in terms of number. The point is that you may have 15 media houses or 20 media houses.
Mm.
The key question is, how do all these different media look at the issue? How do they deal with the Muslim question? How do they approach the right-wing Hindu extremism?
Mm.
So with some minor differences, you will see that all of them, they speak one language.
Right.
And that language is of an ethnic Hindu nationalism in which Muslims are the prime enemy.
Right.
And this is routinely telecast, printed. Now, of course, I should say that they don't do it identically. So there are differences.
Yeah.
And these are some of the names you audience in India would probably clearly identify those names. So, for example, you have people like Arnab Goswami or Anjana Om Kashyap. So these are the aggressive proponents in the media.
These are anchors, news anchors, maybe.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So they speak loud, aggressively. And then there are others like Rajdeep Sardesai or even Siddharth Vardarajan. They may not be speaking aggressively. Mm. They may be even smiling. But their thought in the ultimate analysis is Islamophobic. And in my view, I think this smile, which often is more fake than genuine, this smile is as dangerous as the aggression that you find in Arnab Goswami or Anjana Om Kashyap.
So the latter two would belong to what we would broadly call the liberal press, and the first two probably the more nationalist press. And your point is, it doesn't really matter because these are just different forms of a very rapid Islamophobia.
That is correct, with some qualifications.
Qualifications, yeah.
Yes. So these Siddharth and Rajdeep Sardesai, they are taken as liberal, also secular.
Yeah.
But in the ultimate analysis, if you see it, the idea of India that it is a Hindu nation.
Mm.
Okay. So even when they speak sometimes in a very patronizing way about Muslims,
yes,
they keep the idea of India as a nation of Hindus,
yes,
and then they try to find some space for Muslims,
yeah,
but not in the ways in which Muslims themselves would like to find their place in India,
right,
but the ways in which they think that the Muslims should think, act, and behave.
Mm.
And that is where the problem lies.
Right.
Because I think, for me, Muslims are not an statistical entity.
Mm.
Muslims are a cultural entity. Muslims are a thinking entity.
Yes.
So you have even people like Nobel laureate Amartya Sen, who proudly say that we have the largest Muslims largest number of Muslims in India.
Yeah.
Now, the point is that it is a statistical or numerical claim.
Mm.
But the point is, does Amartya Sen also think of Muslims in not simply statistical terms?
Yes.
Because Muslims also have a tradition. They have their ways of thinking.
Yes.
They have a philosophy. They have a literature. Are you taking those traditions and thoughts into account? Or you want Muslims to act and think based on the parameters of Hindu philosophy which you have instituted in the name of nationalism?
Right.
And that, I think, is a very critical point.
Yeah. No, that's really interesting. And I saw recently, and it became an issue on social media, there was a circulation of a video showing two Christian women in Manipur who were stripped and paraded through the street and then ultimately abused and raped. Can you shed light on the context behind this video? And is Hindu nationalism as antagonistic towards other minority groups as it is Muslims, as they are Muslims?
Yeah, so I personally did not watch that video, but I read about it because in any case, later on, this was removed from the social media.
Yeah.
It was so horrific.
Yeah.
Now, clearly, it is unacceptable and it is shameful. And a practice like that in a democracy is simply, in a genuine democracy, it should not occur in the first place.
Yeah.
But now, back to this video.
Mm.
So, see, this incident happened in a state which is called Manipur, and the map that I showed to you, it is in the northeastern part of India.
Right.
And it is a small estate.
Hmm.
Yeah, so right in the north there. Northeast.
Yeah.
So if you bring your finger down.
Yeah. Manipur is here, yes.
The one in green.
Right.
So it is a small estate. Now, to understand the political context of that violence, for your viewers, of course, it is a very complex situation in terms of ethnicity, language, history, and political formation.
Yes.
But for the purpose of this conversation, so there are two main communities.
Right.
Okay? The majority Hindu Methi community.
In Manipur. Yes.
In Manipur.
Yeah.
And then you have Kukis, who are predominantly Christians.
Right.
Okay? Now, Methis are in majority both numerically, but also in terms of power, because minority, after all, is not simply a numerical thing. Minority is a relationship of power.
Right.
You also have 8 or 9% of Muslims, but they don't matter. Okay. So what happened is that this there has been conflict and clashes between the Hindu, largely Hindu Methi community, and the Kukis, who are Christians.
Yeah.
But this would not have been possible, the context of the video, without this political development. Now, what is this political development?
Yes.
It is this. Until 2012, so BJP had no elected member in the local legislative assembly. Okay, its share of vote was only 2.1%.
Yeah.
Now, you have election. So in 2014, Modi comes to power at federal level or the central level. There is election in 2017, and you see a sudden rise in BJP. So their share of vote increases from 2.1% to 36.3%.
Wow. Yeah.
Okay. And then they're able to form the first government. Now, the chief minister of that estate is from the Hindu majority community.
Mm.
So now, emboldened by the national scene, okay, now BJP wants to implement its ethnic Hindu nationalist idea all over India, including in Manipur.
Mm.
And where these Kukis, who are Christians, you know, there are also, by the way, issues of land ownership, because the Manipur, it comprises of the hill areas and the valley.
Right.
So the Christian Kukis, they are mostly in the hills. And Hindus are mostly in the valley.
Right.
Now, even though their number is quite significant, but only 20, so the state legislative assembly, it has 60 members, but maximum you can have only 20 from the Kuki community. So in any case, the Hindus will have the political majority. So they are, the Kukis, they are also in a way contesting that political marginalization. So, but we cannot understand what happened in this horrific video is, we cannot understand it unless we relate it to the national situation,
right,
which is the emboldening of Hindu fascism and its grand plan to implement the Hindu ideology in every state.
Mm.
And Manipur is simply another, so some people have described it that, well, the first laboratory of Hindu fascism was Gujarat
right.
in 2002.
Yes.
When anti-Muslim pogrom happened.
Mm.
Now, Manipur is second.
Really?
And in this case, because in this northeastern part of India,
yeah.
you have also other states which have significant Christian population.
Right.
Okay. So in that sense, it becomes significant.
Okay. No, thank you. That's very, very informative. So is it then fair to say that Hindu nationalism has an equally antagonistic view towards all non-Hindu religious groups?
Yes, but they also have a hierarchy of enemy.
So is Islam at the top of that hierarchy?
Yes.
Muslims.
And we can probably get to that idea when we go to the ideology of BJP
yeah.
and RSS.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So of course, this ideology emerged when Britain was still ruling India.
Mm.
So at that time, they were not as open against Christians.
Mm.
I mean, they were.
Mm.
But in this ideology, because Muslims also, so religiously speaking, after Hindus,
mm.
Muslims are the second largest religious community.
So it's around 200 million. I think that's the figure I gave at the beginning. Is that an accurate?
That is correct. So yeah. we had census in 2011. So it is decennial census. So there yes. will be another one. It should be probably out soon. So in that census, it was 14.5%
wow.
Muslims.
Yes.
Okay. And as you know, the total population of India is already over 1 billion,
billion yeah.
right?
Yeah.
But of course, we have to also take this demographic data
mm.
With a pinch of salt because demography has always been historically enmeshed
mm.
In politics,
mm.
How you count, which state has been counted properly or not, and so on and so forth.
Right.
But clearly, this is a vast number of Indians who are Muslims.
Yes.
So for the idea of an ethnic Hindu state to be fully workable,
mm.
Muslims are taken by the Hindu extremist. As the greatest impediment, because it is based on the idea that it is a democracy.
Yes.
So of course there are Christians, but their number is very less.
Mm.
So in electoral term, they may not matter. Okay, but Muslims would matter. But also the fact that Muslims have been the presence of Muslims in India has been long. It has had a thriving culture, actually, whether it is in terms of language or civilizational ethos,
mm.
Islam has played a key role.
Yeah.
So it is for this reason that Muslims become the prime enemy of Hindu nationalisms.
So it's a good time then to talk about Hindu nationalism. Now, you sent me a very persuasive piece, a great piece on that you wrote an essay on Hindu Orientalism, and I think your basic argument is that this type of nationalism pervades Indian society. It's not just restricted to the BJP, but I suppose it's also the case that the BJP government has used Hindu nationalism as a tool. To marginalize Muslims, but also as a tool for electoral success. So we hear a lot about the BJP's ideology, Hindutva, and you've mentioned Hindutva on a number of occasions today. So how does Hindutva differ to the religion of Hinduism?
Yeah, so this is, again, this is a very good question, and it actually comes to, it touches the heart of discussion. About contemporary politics. So broadly speaking, there are two positions. One position maintains that actually Hindutva and Hinduism, to use a peculiar British English phrase, they are as different as cheese and chalk, right? So in this position, these are two completely different things. Now, among academics, Ashish Nandi was the one who made this distinction. Now, there is a valuation behind this distinction, and we should get this. Now, what is that distinction based on? This distinction is based on the idea that Hinduism is a political, it is a spiritual, tolerant repository of ideas, whereas Hindutva is a political thing.
So okay? Hinduism is apolitical and Hindutva is political. Yes.
That is one way to read it.
Yes.
Ashish Nandi would say that Hinduism is a faith and Hindutva is an ideology, a political ideology.
Yeah.
Right? Now, I'm not, I think this distinction is not entirely correct.
Right.
And let me say why. So for me, I think the question is not that Hindutva is political and Hinduism is apolitical. No, in my view, both are political.
Right.
Okay? So let's stick to this, those who make the distinction between Hinduism as faith and Hindutva as an ideology.
Yes.
There are others who say that actually there is no difference. Although you will find this voice very rare in at least articulated in public.
Yes.
Now, many Hindus themselves, they think that actually Hindutva and Hinduism is the same. And you have somebody called Lokesh, who was director of Indian Council for Cultural Relations. So not only he thinks that Hindutva is Hinduism, he went to the extent of saying that Modi is God.
Yeah.
Okay? So when you have a description like this, then the distinction between Hindutva and Hinduism is collapsed.
Right.
Okay? My own theoretical take is that rather than making this distinction, what we can safely say that definitely Hindus prior to 19th century, okay, which is to say that the political and social lives of Hindus prior to the rise of nationalism and after the rise of nationalism, these are two different things.
Right.
So we cannot think of what is happening to India in a pre-nationalism age. So in that sense, it is difference, but not in the sense that, oh, one is simply a spiritual entity and another is a political entity and therefore ideological.
Professor Ahmed, I would like to ask you about the RSS movement, because, of course, you've explained what the BJP is. The BJP is the governing party, the party of Modi, but we also hear a lot about RSS. Is it a social movement? And just tell me a little bit about its background and why it's so controversial.
This is also quite a critical question. So I think it is the best word to describe it is that it is not a social movement in the sense we understand green movement or even Tablighi Jamaat movement. It is a paramilitary militia kind of movement,
right.
And it was established in 1925.
Yeah.
Now, without going into much details, I just want to tell the viewers what actually it stands for. So, although it was established in 1925, but the Bible of its ideology came in 1923 by Vinayak Damodar Savarkar. And he wrote a book which is called Hindutva. Now, Hindutva basically literally means Hinduness. So in that sense, it is not a problematic term. But the way he defined Hindutva, so his definition, he wanted India to be a nation state. in the sense of Western European nation state, okay? And given the immense diversity in India, he sought to have an ethnically purified vision of India. Right. Now, in that vision, everything is Hindu.
Right.
So to cut it short, his definition of who is an Indian, and he took Indian as a substitute to Hindu.
Wow.
Okay? So Indian and Hindu qualifies as equivalent.
Yes.
So he gave these three core thing that only he or she would be considered as Indian who takes India as her motherland and also as her ancestral land.
Right.
And as finally holy land.
Mm. But how different is this discourse from, say, that of the more tolerant discourse we're used to hearing of Mahatma Gandhi, for example?
Yeah, so this is, I mean, there are people who take Gandhi as opposite of RSS.
Mm.
In my view, he's not actually opposite of RSS. And there are also a few scholars who have made this point that actually he's a moderate version of that.
Really?
Yes.
So he believes in Hindu nationalism, a Hindu Rashtra.
Yes. Really. So the difference is more in terms of the modes of realizing it rather than the actual content of it.
Right.
Now, so back to this Savarkar vision.
Mm.
But this was in 1923. Now, RSS, the second chief of the RSS, M.S. Golwalkar, he wrote a book which is called We, or Our Nationhood Defined. Right. And Golwalkar was clearly... He writes in the book that his source of inspiration is Hitler.
Hmm.
So this is a Nazi ideology, and I want the viewers to take this into consideration, because in that book, he clearly says that non-Hindus, okay, and in a way it ties to the Savarkar's definition of India, because Muslims do not consider India as their Punya Bhumi, holy land, okay? So he extends this, and he is very clear that what non-Hindus should do, or what would be the future of non-Hindus.
Mm.
So he says, and let me quote this, and this is from Golwalkar from this book published in 1939. The non-Hindu people in Hindustan must either adopt the Hindu culture and language, must learn to respect and hold in reverence Hindu religion, must entertain no idea but those of glorification of the Hindu race and culture. In one word, they must cease to be foreigners, or they may stay in the country wholly subordinated to the Hindu nation, claiming nothing, deserving no privilege, far less preferential treatment, not even citizens' rights.
Mm.
So this is said in 1939, and I think what we are facing today, so it is not simply a word which has been put on paper. Mm-hmm. Now you see this actually in practice.
Right. So the realization of that vision is really through Modi and the BJP government.
And also take into consideration that this vision... And this is an important question for any person interested in democracy.
Mm.
So it is a paramilitary organization. Modi himself is a member of that party.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
And by the way, RSS members are not just within BJP. You will find RSS people also in other parties, like in the Congress, in Samajwadi Party.
Right.
And this is not I am saying, but... a spokesperson of the RSS.
Yeah.
He has said that our people are in every party.
Yeah.
But more importantly, I don't understand this, that so they have they have a shakhas, which is like training camp.
Mm.
And every city and town has that drill session.
Mm.
They wear white shirt and knicker, half pants, which is also inspired by Hitler's SSS and so on.
Mm.
So they do this military training in every town and city.
Wow.
So it works like a parallel organization. So I don't understand why in a democracy you will have a paramilitary organization, because in a democracy, the citizens have to put their faith in a state and legalized institution like the police, the judiciary, rather than having something which is outside this realm.
Mm.
But this has existed.
Right.
And many of these, like the violence which has happened in Haryana and Gurgaon, many of them would be connected to allied organization of the RSS.
Really?
So not directly member of the RSS, but then RSS also function by establishing other groups like Vishv Hindu Parishad, like Bajrang Dal, which is a militant wing of the youth, which indulges in street violence.
Mm.
Right?
Yeah.
So this is how this ideology and practice go together.
Now, there's a lot in the Indian press about, of course, about Muslims. One of the key lines of maligning Muslims is the connection with the Mughal Empire. The Mughal Empire was the last Muslim empire that ruled over India for many centuries. And there is an attempt to revise, a revisionist attempt to revise Mughal history in the school textbooks. I remember some discussion about the 17th century ruler Aurangzeb in Indian media and the characterization of Aurangzeb as an Islamic extremist. So just lay out why the Mughal Empire is so problematic to these Hindutva people.
Yeah, so this is a very relevant question.
Hmm.
And I think the root cause of this is that the entire demonization of the Mughal rule is actually historically and intellectually indebted to British or Western Orientalism.
Right.
Now, what I mean by this, I mean this. So see, when the British colonized India, in order to legitimize their own rule as benign and also beneficial, they started constructing the Mughals as malignant and bad force. Okay? Because this is to tell the Indians that, look, we have colonized you and we are better than the previous rulers. But what the British also did was to say that, look, we are not the first outsiders to rule India. Mughals were also outsiders. So you have two things happening here. Externalization of Muslims, okay, that they are not from India, from outside, just as the British are. And then the demonization, because without this demonization, you cannot tell Indian people that, look, how good we are to you as Indians, because we have brought progress, we have brought modernization and so on. Now, the depiction of Indian history happened along these lines, and two key historians were Eliot and Dowson. So they created even a chronology by saying that Hindu India, Muslim India, and then the British India. Once you have this linear classification, Hindu India, Muslim India, and British India. Now, of course, when you say Muslim India, when the Mughals ruled, but in the Mughal administration, there are also Hindus who have been at key position,
right?
Yes. But once you create this kind of thing, then it is like depicting them as three successive linear stages in history, and also as opposed to each other. Now, this was for a variety of reasons. Many Hindus themselves, so this is the British creation, but Hindus found it useful.
Yes.
So you have somebody like called Raja Ram Mohan Rai, who is considered as leader of the Indian Renaissance.
Mm.
And he described his on record to say that we do not, and by we he means probably Hindus, that we do not regard the British as colonizers, but as liberators.
Really?
Yes.
Liberating from Muslim rule.
Which, using the Orientalist vocabulary, mm-hmm. he described Muslim rule as Mohammedan despotism.
Wow.
And then described Hindus as original inhabitants.
Yeah.
So what you see that Raja Ram Mohan Rai, Chris Bailey, the famous British historian,
mm.
he described Raja Ram Mohan Rai as the first Indian liberal. But if that is what liberalism means,
mm.
so you see, when you say Hindus as original inhabitants, Mohammedan word gets identified with despotism mm. as an outsider, and British colonialism as deliverer and liberator. So you see, the seeds of violence is already there.
Yeah.
Now, it is in this framework that Aurangzeb becomes the villain of not simply RSS and BJP. You will find that there are many people outside of RSS and BJP. Mm. They also have a similar view of Aurangzeb.
Right.
Now, there are many historians who have written books about Aurangzeb.
Yes.
It is not entirely accurate the way he's being demonized. I mean, there was a historian called B.N. Pandey who wrote a book on Aurangzeb.
Mm.
And it is forgotten that Aurangzeb also gave land grant, to many temples as well.
Mm. Hindu temples. Yeah.
Yes. But also keep in mind that this demonization of Aurangzeb is at radical variance with Muslims' perception of Aurangzeb.
Mm.
For many Muslims, Aurangzeb is quite closer to the idea of a good leader because the kind of lifestyle he used to lead.
Right.
He did not take money for his own from the exchequer of the government. He used to sew caps, and the money that he used to earn from that, he used to spend on his own food.
Wow.
But also, he has this idea of justice. So he would have an audience with people. Even a commoner could come and have an audience with him about justice and so on. Mm. So for Muslims, Aurangzeb is something entirely different. The way and the Hindus, they depict him as complete villain. Now, of course, as a historian or academic, the point is not to endorse this or that view, but assess what actually historical evidence show, and clearly historical evidence do not show that he was. Such a bad fellow.
Yeah.
He also did a lot of things, but he's mobilized in order to enact this politics of enmity, hatred, which is what you see all over India since 2014, especially.
And is there any truth in the Hindutva narrative that Muslim India treated Hindus as second-class citizens?
So a proper response would be from a historian who has done enough work. I'm not a historian, but what I can say, and this is crucial, that, see, Al-Biruni, who wrote a book on India, and he was a scholar who went there, lived with Hindus, also learned Sanskrit.
Really?
Yes.
He was an Arab scholar?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Abul Kalam Azad, he attributes this term to Al-Biruni, saying that, so in the Islamic worldview, of course, you have the notion of Ahl al-Kitab.
Mm. Jews and Christians, right.
Yeah. So through Al-Biruni, Abul Kalam Azad refers to this description of Hindus as Shibh Ahl al-Kitab.
Right.
So, which is, and I'm not an expert of fiqh either, but shib literally means something which is closer to like a resemblance. So they are not Ahle Kitab in the sense of Jews and Christian, but shib is like something closer to it. So there were also ways to deal with religious differences. And my point is that there were, I mean, in Mughal bureaucracy, you have many Hindus who were at key position. There were finance minister who were Hindus. This goes, and also defense minister, especially in the reign of Akbar. Now, the point is that we should also keep in mind that we cannot judge the political history of that era from the standard of today.
Right.
Because the idea of equality that we have today, that did not exist at that time. But I would go one step further and say that, okay, for theoretical reason, we accept that there has been discrimination. But by the way, this discrimination, I mean, you also have poor Muslims, weavers, right? But Mughals generally, they did not interfere in the religious life of Hindus,
right.
Okay? But the point is, for the sake of argument, even if we accept that there has been some ill treatment for the sake of argument, then the point is the way you mobilize it now, okay? What is the goal of that mobilization? Of course, you are using or you use that invented idea to impact and make the life of Muslims difficult and impossible.
Yeah.
Right?
Can I ask you about, now that's a really good understanding. Can I ask you then about liberal India? We've got Rahul Gandhi, who is, of course, the leader of the opposition Congress party. You've got Shashi Tharoor, who, again, is quite popular in the West, and he's written some books, which one can interpret to be a little bit more inclusive, I suppose, of Muslims. His book on Mughal India did merit Mughal India for its substantial work on improving and creating the world's largest economy of its time. So you've got figures like this, and some Muslims may come to the conclusion that we need to support these liberal guys, these Congress politicians, because they would deliver us from this fascism that has undertaken, that has taken over India. And is that narrative a little bit too simplistic?
Yeah, so you see here, in such a formulation, the assumption is that party politics is the key to understand what is happening in India. And I'm interested in party politics as well, but there is something which goes beyond party politics. So it is the shared ideology of India as a Hindu nation, which informs BJP, RSS as much as it does. It does impact and influence even communist, I would say, and Congress,
right.
Because the existing Communist Party, by the way, historically, as you know, communism is about international movement. But the Indian communists, they operate within the Indian national framework.
Really?
And they also, in many ways, reproduce that idea of India as a Hindu nation, not in the same way as BJP and Congress does.
Right.
Now, back to Rahul Gandhi and Shashi Tharoor. So I would say that if we do not see Indian politics in terms of party politics, but something which is supra party, the idea of India, what has been India and what India wants to be. So that idea of an ethnic Hindu nation, it cuts across the political parties.
Mm.
Now, Rahul Gandhi, I mean, Congress itself, after the Babri Masjid was demolished, now, the general narrative is that, well, the BJP and the RSS and VHP, they have been responsible for the demolition of the Babri Masjid.
Yes.
After the Babri Masjid was demolished and the Supreme Court judgment came, validating that demolition in some ways, you have many prominent Congress leaders in UP, and this included the chief of the UP Congress, saying that, no, actually, we also played a key role in the demolition of the Babri Masjid.
Mm.
Right? Rahul Gandhi himself has been adopting a soft Hindutva.
Yeah.
Now, about Shashi Tharoor, I think his take on British colonialism, his critical take on Churchill, I'm quite a fan of it.
Mm.
And it is good that he brought such things to the public.
Yes.
But when it comes to Islamic issues, Shashi Tharoor is no different. I mean, probably the difference is that unlike the BJP and RSS and Arnab Goswami, who uses an aggressive language, Shashi Tharoor has got a decent vocabulary, and he also speaks with some smile. But the content of that Islamophobia is there in a different way. But let me say this, that if we take Hindu politics, beyond party politics, beyond Congress versus BJP.
Yes.
Here, so the commonality that I have highlighted across political parties,
yes.
This is, you will see that even Gandhi has that idea. Okay?
Mahatma Gandhi or Rahul Gandhi?
No, Mahatma Gandhi.
Right.
Well, Mahatma is the title, but the name is Mohandas Karamchand Gandhi.
Mm.
Now, as you know, the Dalit leader, Ambedkar, he used to say that I refuse to call him Mahatma because the term literally means the great soul or probably the greatest soul, Mahatma. So Gandhi, and probably this is something for the viewers to take into consideration. Now, Gandhi is considered as someone who has stood for an inclusive India. He was for Hindu-Muslim unity and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And above all, he's icon of nonviolence.
Mm.
So you have people like Barack Obama praising him.
Yes.
But I always wonder that, well, is Barack Obama really aware of Gandhi's thought?
Mm.
And I want to say here is that actually how Gandhi's elements of Gandhi's thought is so violent, especially when it comes to Muslim issues.
Evidence that. I mean, you know, how do we know that he had these very violent views towards Muslims?
Yeah, and I'll just explain that. But I would say that actually the contemporary forms of lynching of Muslims, it is, many people think that this is a departure from Gandhian values,
yes,
or Gandhian ideology.
Yeah.
I will just explain to you that actually it is a homage to Gandhi.
Right.
And it is actually derived from teachings of Gandhi.
Wow.
Now how? So see, Gandhi was killed on 31st of January.
Mm.
2nd of January, he holds a prayer meeting. Okay? Mm. Now, a Hindu has written a letter to him. So we are talking about the first week of January 1948. Mm. India got independence in August 1947.
Okay.
So it is just within a few months. So a Hindu asked him that if there was a war between India and Pakistan, and that Hindu assumes that Muslims of India will not be loyal to the Indian Union or the Indian state, but rather side with Pakistan.
Mm.
So that Hindu is asking Gandhi that should not Muslims be expelled before that war happens because they will not be loyal to the Indian state. So in that prayer meeting, this letter is written in to Gandhi in English, but he replies in Hindi. So he's addressing this question, and let me quote it. So this is Gandhi's reply.
Please, yeah.
Do I imagine that crores of Muslims in India will be loyal to India and fight against Pakistan? We must not assume anyone to be bad till he has been proven to be bad. If later they, meaning Muslims, betray you, you can shoot them. You may shoot one or two or a certain number. Mm-hmm. Everyone will not be disloyal. Wow. We must be brave and trust the Muslims. If later they violate the trust, you can cut off their heads. This is in collected works of Mahatma Gandhi, volume 98, page number 160 and 61.
Wow.
Now imagine you have collected volumes of 98. There are more volumes. I'm not a scholar of hadith, but I am. How many volumes of hadith are there? So everything that Gandhi has said, it is collected. It is gone into over 100 volumes.
Yes.
Now, what you see, if you read this quote closely, so there are two things. If Muslims betray, you can cut off their heads. It doesn't occur to Gandhi that Hindus can also be disloyal. There's nothing in blood or religion, because you are talking about nation state. So he takes the Hindu questioner's assumption that only Muslims would be disloyal.
Mm.
And as we know from history, there have been many Hindus who have worked against the national interest of India.
Yes.
Right? So it doesn't occur to him that Hindus could also be loyal. He takes the assumption that Muslims would be disloyal. But then, if they are loyal and you want, so the proper legal mechanism would be that you put those disloyal Muslims in a court on trial. And if the court makes this judgment that they have betrayed India, then you can deliver the punishment, whether it is in terms of execution or jail. In this answer, Gandhi is telling his audience and addressing the questioner that you can shoot them. Now, what is lynching? Lynching technically is that rather than the official of the state, it is the non-state actors, civil society actors, who take law into their own hands and kill a people, rather than a court judgment which tells that, okay, this person should be executed, right? So in this quote, Gandhi is indirectly asking the citizens to take law into their own lands. And that way, what you see today in terms of lynching,
yes,
because it is an illegal act,
yes,
right?
Yeah.
So in my view, it is not a departure from Gandhian thought.
It's the logic of it, yeah.
It is extension.
Yeah, yeah. Can I ask you about the international response to Modi's India, to his fascism? Now, I talk about how we live in an age of impunity. Why has there been near silence on the backsliding of democracy in India? I mean, Joe Biden, he speaks against human rights abuses around the world. Yet when it comes to India, neither does he speak against India, nor does he, in fact, he in a way sanctions, he permits this, these acts of violence by courting India. India is a member of his Summit for Democracies, where he brings the world's democracies together, and of course he's trying to develop a consensus against the autocracies in the world. Pakistan is excluded from that, even though they have elections, because Pakistan is seen to be an imperfect democracy or non-democracy, whereas India is seen to be other than bad. Modi was on a visit to the United States not so long ago. What's going on here? Why is the international community silent about what seems to be the road to some form of genocide in India?
This is a sort of difficult question to answer. But let me say this, that this coalition of democracies,
yes,
America, India, Britain, France, and so on and so forth. Now, when these powers speak of democratic values, now India projects itself as the largest democracy, America is the oldest democracy. But if you see the histories of these democracies, they have not always been for democracy.
Right.
Now, the part of the history of democracy, and I alluded to this briefly earlier, with the example of Roosevelt and what happened to the Aboriginals in Australia.
Yes.
But these democracies have also been engaged in what I call de-democratization, which means how it has been engaged in toppling elected governments. From Chile in 1971 or 72, Allende was elected leader. There was a coup against Allende. Yeah. In 1953, Mossadegh elected government was overthrown. Yeah. So the point here is that these democracies or the history of democracy after World War II is also enmeshed simultaneously in de-democratizing polities. This has happened in Muslim countries as well. You could think of already 1953 Mossadegh, but you know Morsi's government also, not in the same way as Mossadegh, in a slightly complex way.
Yeah. But it's a soft coup, yeah.
Yeah, and this happened, by the way, in early 70s in Bahrain.
Yeah.
Okay, so you have many examples of these de-democratization. So when these democracies come together and speak in terms of values of democracy, sometimes I'm reminded, and maybe I think probably I will have to switch now from English into Urdu.
Yeah.
So there's this poet, Rahat Indori. He died during the COVID. So he had this very pertinent couplet, and which, so let me say this. He said, "Jhooton ne jhooton se kaha hai, sach bolo. Sarkari elan hua hai, sach bolo. Ghar ke andar jhooton ki ek mandi hai, darwaze pe likha hua hai, sach bolo." So such kind of conversation, it... I'm not saying that this is the only thing, but in this particular context, it also, it refers to like, you know, a set of liars telling another set of liars that let's speak truth. Okay? Now, the reason why the West quotes Modi, now you mentioned Quad and so on and so forth. So, of course, it is to counter China and so on. There's also an argument that, look, India is the largest market. So the West wants to do business.
Right.
And there are people who have said that, no, from the Western world, you will not hear anything about violation of democracy or human rights because it is party to this alliance to counter China.
Yes.
But then if that is the case, and if it is simply raw or brute politicking, then the question is, what happens to the idea of norms?
Yes.
What happens to values?
Human rights.
Human rights.
Yeah.
And that, I think, and this may not be a practical response to your question, but
yeah.
I think at the theoretical level, my sense is that, look, the world order or the world disorder that we have after World War II in the form of the United Nations, so it is a world of nation state. Now, the chief working axiom of this world order is ruthless pursuit of national interest, right? Every nation state is engaged in pursuing its own national interest.
Yes.
And then, of course, you have coalition and alliances. Now, this whole idea of national interest, the way modern politics works, this national interest is based on the idea of enmity. So Carl Schmitt, who was sympathetic to fascism, so he takes politics as making setting friends,
yes,
apart from enemy. And this is this enemy-friend dualism. It is actually the core of post-World War political order or disorder.
Mm.
And then, and it is it anchors in the name of national interest.
Fantastic, yeah.
Once you have this, then the idea of violation of human rights, of dignity of women, like, for example, this horrific video of women raped and paraded in Manipur.
Mm.
So all these things will be subordinated,
yeah,
to that brutal logic of national interest. Now, sometimes I also think that, like, you know, this genocidal violence which has happened against Rohingyas, mm, right? If it had happened to a section of people in Europe, would the Western world have responded differently, mm, right?
Mm.
But I think, and this is probably not an optimistic note to make, but I think there is a hierarchy of human lives. So certain forms of life of certain humans have been given more respect and attention than the life of certain other social groups. Mm. And unless we do away with that hierarchy, mm, and really come to a genuine egalitarianism where humans are not ranked or graded based on now either racism, nationalism. Now there is also logic of civilizationalism. Mm. So both India and China, they are actually enemies in some ways,
mm,
but both use this language of civilizational nationalism.
Yes.
China has been a great civilization since time immemorial,
yeah,
and India makes the same argument, right? So we have to have really a radically new understanding of humans, where these gradation and hierarchy is done away with. And once we get to that stage only, then I think, mm, we'll be in a position to talk about suffering,
mm,
of all, and really create a beautiful world. Because what we are confronted with today is all awful. And this awful, by the way, is legitimized,
mm,
by lawful. So law, because the moment you say that law and order has to be maintained,
mm,
so this is lawful, but lawful is not necessarily and always beautiful. There are many things in the world which has been awful, but it has been lawful in the sense that apartheid in South Africa, it was awful, but it was lawful.
Mm.
It was legitimized by law.
Yeah.
We as humans, I think we have to aspire more towards not simply lawful, but a lawful that is also beautiful.
Mm.
It is for humanity. It is for not simply for humans in, but also it is sensitive to the larger idea of universe in which rivers, animals, insects, and butterflies and cats, they all have their rightful and dignified place.
Can I ask you one last question? It's been a fascinating discussion, and I've really valued your responses to my questions. There is a raw feeling amongst Indian Muslims, and I sense it also when I speak to Pakistani Muslims, that we have, 200 million Muslims in India today. We have, that's the third largest population of Muslims in the world, in fact. But in 1947, when India and Pakistan separated, both Muslims decided to remain in India. Was it a mistake to stay in India? And should those Muslims, your parents, your grandparents possibly, should they have moved to Pakistan?
This question in its axiom, a little bit problematic because there's nothing called Muslims decided or chose to remain in India.
Right.
Now, why I'm saying this? See, there's whole library written on partition and so on. I think from the Pakistani side also, there is some quite a bit of damage done to the historical facts. Look, the best definition of partition that I uphold and I have written about it. So, see, Sardar Vallabhbhai Patel, who became the home minister, and he was from the same estate as your grandparents or forefathers, Gujarati.
Yes.
Right? So he says that partition was cutting off the diseased limb. Now, what does it mean? So here is the idea that from 19th century onwards, and I made this reference the key leader of Indian Renaissance, Raja Ram Mohan Roy. So from that time onwards, you have the idea of India as a Hindu and pure nation. Okay? Now, Muslims were, but of course from Raja Ram Mohan Roy until Patel, there is a long time. So it is not like it happened just in one go, you know? So slowly, so once you have that idea of a purified ethnic Hindu nation, Muslims were seen simply as detrimental. So it is like a healthy body, nation as a healthy Hindu body, and Muslims were taken as a diseased part of that body.
Right.
So it needs to be cut off. Now, what partition is, that of course for Hindus, and this is Vajpayee, by the way, who was prime minister and who died, and he is considered a liberal RSS member. He is on record to say that partition was a good thing. So why it is a good thing? Because the Muslim majority areas, which now constitute today, after 97, Bangladesh and Pakistan. So these Muslim areas, they were wanting their own autonomy. Okay? And speaking on behalf of Muslims, so once you have territorially separated them and given them a state, separate state.
Yeah.
Now, Muslims who remain in India. So there was in partition drama, there is nothing called that, oh, you have a choice. Actually, you have worked by historians when Muslims were going from India to Pakistan. So after a few months, this is in Jung, and there is a cartoon, it says that Pakistan is full. Which is to say that now you don't come because our geography is definite and we cannot accommodate all Muslims. So it was not in the sense of like, oh, Muslims have been given a choice to go. There's nothing like that. And for Hindu nationalists also, if you have a small population, that is not a problem. So this is what Vajpayee said, that partition was a good thing. We have now less Muslims, and it is easier to manage them. Right? Yeah. So it is not in terms of choice. But what I want to say here that Pakistan as an entity, as a name. So please keep in mind that before 1947, there is nothing called Pakistan.
Yes.
Right? But the enmity against Islam exists prior to 1947. So that time, the Hindu nationalism or mainstream Indian nationalism conducts itself against Islam, against Muslims.
Yes.
Now, what happens after 1947, the Indian politicians or people like even Shashi Tharoor, if they do not use the word Islam, but when they use the word Pakistan, and Pakistan in Indian nationalism is a bad word, So when you say that that guy is a Pakistani, that means you are being disloyal, right? You are not being tolerant. You are exclusivist. So even for these liberals, when they use word Pakistan, it basically means that something, because of certain liberal constraints, you cannot say Muslims and you cannot give them, you cannot abuse them. So Pakistan becomes a word of abuse.
Right.
And that is why it is kept alive, like on a daily basis, 24/7. You cannot read a newspaper in India or watch a television without or films or even public conversation with friends without mention of Pakistan.
Professor Irfan Ahmed, it's really been a pleasure speaking to you today. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, and it was lovely to speak to you.
Please remember to subscribe to our social media and YouTube channels and head over to our website, thinkinmuslim.com, to sign up to my weekly newsletter. Jazakallah khair.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.